Before we begin today's episode, I want to share something really special with you, something I've been pouring my heart into. If you've been feeling tired in a way that sleep doesn't fix, if you've noticed you're carrying tension all the time, or you're stuck in that cycle of pushing, achieving, caring for everyone else, and running on empty, I've created something just for you. It's a weekend retreat called The Deep Unwind, and I'll be guiding it in person at the beautiful Art of Living Retreat Center in the Blue Ridge Mountains in North Carolina. This experience is for the helpers, the overthinkers, the high achievers, the sensitive souls, the ones who are strong for everyone else, but craving a safe place to finally put down the heavy weight of responsibility and let their shoulders relax. Together, we'll spend the weekend slowing down and gently unwinding the patterns that lead to burnout and self-criticism. Through somatic practices, guided hypnotherapy, nervous system healing, and myofascial release, you'll learn how to feel safe in your body again. You'll learn how to soften your inner critic, and you'll experience how to truly rest. Not just collapse or detach, but to deeply restore. You'll leave feeling lighter, clearer, more grounded, and more connected to yourself than you've felt in a long time. And everyone who joins us will receive a myofascial release kit with my favorite tools that I personally use and teach with, plus a signed copy of my book so you can continue the work at home. If this sounds like exactly what your nervous system has been asking for, I'd love to meet you there. You can learn more and reserve your spot at themindfulmovement.com/retreat. I look forward to welcoming you to the deep unwind.
I absolutely agree with reverse as far as hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, due to increased stress, for example, and more of that protective mechanism. With hyperthyroidism, it's, again, just because you have so much thyroid hormone and, you know, because you have a lot of thyroid hormone in there, again, excess of thyroid hormone. So the body not only is over converting T4 to T3, so you get a lot of T3, because again, you have a lot of T4. And as you know, the thyroid gland is mostly producing that T4, but it's also seems like it's over converting to reverse T3.
Dr. Eric Ozanski, thanks for joining me on the Mindful Movement Podcast.
Thank you so much, Les. Excited to be here.
I was excited to see that you guys reached out because, as I was just alluding to before we hit record, I've been, I wouldn't say on a deep dive, but I've been trying to really expand my understanding of thyroid and metabolism over the last year or two. And it seems like everything I find is in the context of hypothyroidism. Like, even when people mention hyper, it's like, oh, that's just hypo misdiagnosed, and make a case. Like, I haven't heard anybody really talk about the other side of the coin. So I was grateful that you guys reached out and I could pick your brain and learn a little bit more about it. You have a background in functional medicine and nutrition, it sounds like. You're also a chiropractic physician. Also an author. You've wrote a few books on the topic, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
What are the names of the books?
So my first book, Natural Treatment Solutions for Hyperthyroidism and Graves' Disease, I released in 2011. And then just in 2023, came out with the third edition for that. Then came out with Hashimoto's Triggers in 2018. And then in 2024, my most recent book, The Hyperthyroid Healing Diet.
Okay. So I assume there's like a pain point that brought you to wanting to studying these fields. I think you mentioned you had Graves at some point. Is that kind of what led you down the path?
Yeah, without question. As you mentioned, my background's a chiropractor, but I was just practicing just regular chiropractic, just not doing anything when it came to thyroid conditions, autoimmune thyroid conditions. And just in 2008, I was diagnosed with hyperthyroidism and then eventually Graves' disease. And that began my journey. Just was able to restore my health, and wasn't sure if I'd be able to do that because again, I was my first thyroid patient, and but I was fortunate enough to accomplish that. And then yeah, after that, I just when you go through your own health journey, a lot of times you develop that passion. And I mean that's how I became a chiropractor. I hurt my back, my low back, and I'm like, okay, yeah, I'm gonna become a chiropractor. And then, I love chiropractic, but just it was just different, a different experience. And just like I said, after I ended up restoring my health, and during the journey, realizing how many others are dealing with thyroid conditions, and there's not really anybody. Even back then, let alone now, focusing on hyperthyroidism. So I'm like, you know what? There's a lot of people who could need my help, and so I started helping people with both hyperthyroidism and Hashimoto's. But because of my background and my experience with hyperthyroidism Graves, I'd say probably about 80% of my patients are those with hyperthyroidism.
Oh, wow. Can you take a moment and just elaborate what is Graves?
Sure. So Graves is an autoimmune condition, more than a thyroid condition. So with Graves, typically you'll have hyperthyroidism. So on a blood test, that'll present as elevated thyroid hormones, T3, T4, and then you're familiar with TSH, thyroid stimulating hormone, which is more of a pituitary hormone. So with hypothyroidism, usually you'll see the TSH higher or elevated. Because you have lower thyroid hormones, might be subclinically low, but either way, the pituitary gland is communicating with the thyroid to produce more thyroid hormone. And with Graves, it's the opposite. You have excess thyroid hormone, and so you see not only low TSH, but usually undetectable TSH, and so like less than 0.001, for example. And so low depressed TSH, elevated thyroid hormones. And then you have just like Hashimoto's, you have antibodies, but the antibodies associated with Graves are what's called thyroid stimulating immunoglobulins, which is a type of TSH receptor antibody. And these seem to bind to the TSH receptors and cause the stimulation, the overproduction of thyroid hormone. And we could definitely get into some of the symptoms, but that
Yeah, I would
essentially
like
is what
to hear
Graves
that.
is.
What about as far as the lab work, where does reverse T3 show up in there? Does it show really low because T3 is high?
No, it's actually the opposite. I stopped testing reverse T3 years ago because just about everybody with hyperthyroidism, they usually have elevated reverse T3. And it kind of makes sense. Like you have a lot of thyroid hormone in the bloodstream. And reverse T3 is kind of like supposedly blocking the action, blocking thyroid hormone. Because you have so much thyroid hormone, it would kind of make sense you have a lot of reverse T3 to trying to block that thyroid hormone from getting into the cell. So just about everybody with not just Graves, but other hyperthyroid conditions like toxic multinodular goiter is a different type of hyperthyroidism. And even with that, we'll usually see elevated reverse T3. So again, I usually don't test for it in my hyper patients just because it really is not going to change my approach. It's not really going to do.
So how do you know it's high? Because isn't the reverse T3 also high? Because and that's blocking that T3 from being able to act?
Sometimes it does, not all the time in hypothyroidism and Hashimoto's, but yeah, it's different. I mean, we're looking. So your question was like, how do you know what the
Well,
reverse
if
T3
reverse
is?
T3, so what I've learned so far that I don't, and I don't know what's absolutely true. I'm just what I hear a lot of, I guess, is in when the thyroid is underproducing, essentially, one of the factors that plays a role is that because of whatever stress or insult is like making metabolism want to slow down, probably to try to help protect you from something. Reverse T3, T4 gets converted more to reverse T3 than T3, binds to that receptor, blocks T3 to potentiate its action. So I could understand if there's hyper that reverse T3 might be high, stopping T3. So you will find elevated T3s floating around because it's not getting bound to where it's not parking. So if you check in the blood, it's going to be high. I could see how that would happen, but Like, I don't understand why would the reverse T3 be high in both scenarios? Like, how would you, or is it, because in that case, it's like, is reverse T3 even useful? But when I listen to people that work with hypothyroid, they find it very useful because it says like, oh, your T3, you might have it, but it ain't working because your reverse T3 is high.
Yeah, it's again, it's just I guess a different mechanism, just with again, when you have too and the T3 is binding to the cell. It's not like none of it's getting to the cell. It's just that you have too much T3, and so I guess in both cases it's like a protective mechanism. So just different. Like yeah, I absolutely agree with reverse as far as hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's. Due to increased stress, for example, and more of a pr that protective mechanism. With hyperthyroidism, it's again just because you have so much thyroid hormone, and because you have a lot of thyroid hormone in there, again, excess of thyroid hormones, so the body not only is overconverting T4 to T3, so you get a lot of T3, because again, you have a lot of T4. And as you know, the thyroid gland is mostly producing that T4, but it's also seems like it's overconverting to reverse T3. Now, again, as practitioners, and you know this, you've interviewed so many practitioners as well, we don't have all the answers, also. So there might be another underlying mechanism that I'm not aware of, but again, to me, it makes sense that, like just about everybody with hyperthyroidism has reverse T3, which is why I don't test for it.
Gotcha.
And so it's like, well, if you have so much thyroid hormone, to me, it would make sense you have a lot of T3, as a protective mechanism to try to block that entry of thyroid hormone into the cell. But again, there could be something else there. As far as I know, there hasn't been any journal articles talking about reverse T3 and hyperthyroidism, and I don't know if there will be in the future,
Gotcha.
but.
So you said the thyroid mostly produces T4. It doesn't do a lot of the conversion from T4 to T3. That's done elsewhere.
Correct. I mean, it does produce some T3, but most of the conversion, like 60% of conversion, takes place in the liver. About 20% takes place in the gastrointestinal tract.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you know where in the GI tract that happens?
I do not.
Huh. And then what does that leave? Another 20%. Where's that? Do you know?
I think some of it, like peripheral tissues.
So the liver is like a major player there. So if somebody's liver is jacked up, that could really hinder your ability. So even though if your thyroid's doing a good job, it gets sent to the liver and the liver might not be able to play its role and convert that and make the T3.
Correct.
Which is
And then,
probably happens a lot. Like people's livers are jacked. Like I
yeah.
think fatty liver is like super common now. And
And
I
then
don't.
our increased toxic burden these
Yeah.
days, of course, yeah.
So Graves has an autoimmune side to it, and that is driving the increased production, or is it the other way around?
No, it is the autoimmune response that is driving the increased production of thyroid hormone. Again, you got those in Hashimoto's, you got thyroglobulin antibodies, and then you got the thyroid peroxidase antibodies. And from what we understand, the antibodies are almost like innocent bystanders. Like they're not actually causing the damage themselves. They're more of a consequence
Okay.
of the damage. But it seems like with Graves, it's actually that those antibodies, the thyroid stimulating immunoglobulins, are actually binding to the TSH receptors, which causing the excess production of thyroid hormone. And the TSI, those thyroid stimulating immunoglobulins, are a result of that autoimmune response. So yeah, it does seem that the autoimmune response is what's causing the hyperthyroidism, if that's what you're asking.
And do you think that is some type of protective mechanism, or at least an attempt at it? Is it? And if so, like how? Like how can that? How would the body be doing that in a way, even if it's like a maladaptive process? Like, is there any rationale for why the body would do that, or is this just like the system is dysfunctional and And it doesn't really.
I think that's the question with all autoimmune conditions,
Right.
like why with MS, why does it, attack the cells in the white matter of the brain, with rheumatoid arthritis, again with Hashimoto's, what's the reason? Is there, I don't think we've established any type of protective mechanism, but again, autoimmunity is complex. I'm sure there's a lot of things we do know that. But there's also a lot of things we don't know, and there's also things I'm sure we think we know that we don't really know, and we'll
Right.
find out, in the future. But yeah, it's a good question. So as far, and again, the research doesn't suggest anything related to this, but that doesn't mean it can't be a factor. We just research might have not. I mean, there has been plenty of research on Graves, but as far as conventional medicine, autoimmunity is just kind of unknown from a functional medicine standpoint. I also think it's unknown. I mean, I'm sure you have others spoken about that triad of autoimmunity, the three-legged stool of autoimmunity. But even that, is that, related to like a protective mechanism, or is it just a
It's all
matter?
theoretical now, like the whole molecular mimicry idea. Like, it's all theory. I mean, I've heard people make a convincing argument that it's really a low energy state, and the antibodies are there trying to fix the situation, and we're taking a snapshot, and we're calling the ambulances the problem. Who knows? Hopefully that does get figured out more, and it'll be interesting to see how the research, if there is enough, unfolds. So how did you experience, I guess, like symptomatically, how did you know you had Graves? How did you know something was wrong?
So I was I mean, I it started, I was actually trying to lose weight. I was dieting, I was detoxifying. I was My ideal weight, I like to be 165, 170. I was like 182. And so I was, again, exercising, dieting, detoxifying, probably more, not probably, but more extreme than I should have. And so a few months into the process, I was losing weight. Everything seemed to be going okay. And one day I was walking around, I don't know if they have Sam's Clubs over there in Maryland, but a retail store, kind of like a Costco. And they had one of those automated blood pressure machines, and I took my blood pressure, which was normal, but my heart rate was elevated. It was about 90 beats per minute. And so I was just thinking, well, maybe it's just because I'm walking around. And next few days I just took my heart rate, and it was anywhere between like 90 and 110 beats per minute. And that's when I was suspecting, well, something's got to be wrong. And up until that point,
It was
didn't
just
think.
always then, like even upon waking, or like even if you're just chilling out.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, at sometimes it was higher than at others, but yeah, like it wasn't, when I tested it, which was multiple times per day, it wasn't like in the 60s or 70s. It was always like elevated. So yeah, it was pretty consistent. And again, it was only a few day period before like I decided to go to the medical doctor just to get checked out, and again, started putting the pieces together, the weight loss. I had increased appetite, but again, I figured it was just what I was doing with the diet and kind of restricting.
How much weight loss did you have? What are we talking about here?
So about 42 pounds, I dropped down to 140.
Oh, wow. Over how much time?
Probably like I guess like 4 or 5 months. I mean, it wasn't when I again, it's
Were
been
you
a while,
starving
but
yourself or like we?
I wasn't starving myself, but yeah, I was depriving. So
Gotcha.
yeah, in a way, I guess you could say I was, and I was also overtraining. So I was definitely not listening to my body. I was doing a lot of cardio and just overdoing it. So I think it wasn't just the dieting, but the overtraining as well that was a factor too.
Gotcha. That's interesting because I've heard people talk about how overtraining and the stress associated with that, and caloric restriction and the stress associated with that, slow down metabolism.
Hypothyroidism,
It's like, how do I? Is it just like your genetics will determine like how those stresses are expressed, and some people it turns everything up, and some people it turns things down, or?
it could be, because I'll tell you what, my situation is not an isolated experience. I mean, I've over the years, it's been now 15 plus years of working with, I mean, both hyper and hypo, but again, more so hyper. And yeah, I've had other people in similar situations. I mean, I can't say that's the norm, but it's not uncommon for someone to say, yeah, I was dieting, I was, probably overtraining. And so, yeah, I'm sure, again, one of those situations where we might not know the exact answers, but we do know there are some genetics between behind both Graves and Hashimoto's. And so you're absolutely, or might be right. Like you said, we don't know everything, but maybe genetically being more susceptible to Graves' disease, that's what I ended up developing compared to someone else who might develop hypothyroidism.
If there's a heart rate component, is there a body temperature component too? Do people with hyper have like higher elevated body temperatures? Do you know?
It's funny. I don't I know like Broda Barnes and all that and the body temperature. What I haven't like actively like when I dealt with Graves, for example, I didn't take my body temp. Well, again, I'm sure the doctor did, and n nothing seemed alarm like when I went to the medical doctor to get
Right.
diagnosed and eventually endocrinologist. I'm sure as part of the vital signs, they did take it. Honestly, wasn't focusing on that at the time. I was focusing more on the heart rate, blood pressure. But I haven't noticed with any of my patients as far as elevation in temperature where but I mean, heat intolerance is definitely a common symptom. So it would seem like where coldness is a symptom of
Right.
hypothyroidism, heat, again, a lot of people have, that like what seem to be hot flashes, but more like heat intolerance. So
Interesting.
but yeah, I can't say if it has been increased, if it's increased, I can't say it's something where I've seen like, like it's like 100 or 101 degrees Fahrenheit, like with the average person.
Right.
So it's got to be like probably smaller changes if that.
Did you have anything else that came? So you had weight loss, you had the high heart rate. You mentioned blood pressure. Was that high or low?
It wasn't, well, my blood pressure has always been on the lower side.
Okay.
So I don't remember what my blood pressure was then, but it wasn't high. So it
Okay.
probably was my normal, which again tends to run a little bit low. I had palpitations, heart palpitations, especially at night when everything was quiet and noticing my heart thumping. When I went to do a blood draw, I had some tremors. My hand would shake.
Are palpitations basically from the excess T3 just like pushing the system, like just pushing the heart?
Pretty much, yeah. Just increase, yeah, contraction. So yeah.
Because I've heard people say when they're taking T3 medication that like that's how you know you've gone too far or whatever. If you
It
get
could be,
like
yeah.
you
Makes
become
sense because yeah, you could become hyper by taking
right.
too much thyroid hormone as well. So yes.
I think I have actually experienced that when I was tinkering. I've definitely tinkered with thyroid medication trying to figure a sweet spot, which I have still not figured out.
Are
So
you taking now currently or?
right now I'm not. I'm looking to start
Okay.
again and like kind of start over after wiping the slate clean. I had some benefits and then I changed some things and I don't think I made good changes. And I feel like
Okay.
I have to start over, go back to my original approach and make and like hang out there longer maybe and give it like I don't know how long it should take to get the max benefit and know like where you're balanced and stable or so I'm working with somebody that seems to be pretty experienced with it. It's just there also seems to be just a lot of individual variability of
Yeah.
how people respond. And like if you change other aspects, just like lifestyle changes can help. Like you probably, it sounds like we're about to get into a lot of natural like lifestyle things that you did to pull yourself out of that situation. So like the fact that you can improve things like just speaks to how your lifestyle behaviors or habits affect those systems. So if you're always
Yeah.
changing those things, like you have a lot of moving parts. I feel like I subject myself to a lot of variables and moving parts. And I get w not wonky information, but like sometimes information that's hard to decipher. Like there's been many times, for instance, like I'll start three new supplements within a week. And then if I feel better, I don't know which one. Like, I don't know if I needed all those three. And more likely, I start three and I feel worse. And I'm like, well, two of those might have been helping me and one of them made me worse. And I don't know because I wasn't smart about my process. And I know I'm not alone. Like, people that are into trying different things and experimenting with different diets or whatever, I think a lot of people make that mistake where you're just not changing one variable at a time and then giving it time to get the full dose of information from that variable.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't
it's
know
true.
Why that my personality does that. I mean, it's a blessing and a curse, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Is what it is. I don't know. There's been times where I say I'm going to do it different this time, but I don't.
Yeah, just a personality trait, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. And that probably serves me really well in some aspects of my life. So what? So how'd you pull yourself out of this? Like, how did you heal?
Yeah. So even though I mentioned as a chiropractor, I really just focused on chiropractic in my practice. But whenever I had to take my continuing education credits, I always took nutrition seminars and functional medicine seminars. So actually, they had back then like some functional endocrinology seminars. And so I'd never thought I would need them for myself, but I just took it just because I was interested in nutrition and the information. And so when I was diagnosed with hyperthyroidism and eventually Graves, again, I wasn't sure if what I learned would work at those seminars, but I knew I would give it a try. And so one thing that's important to mention is symptom management. So before we get into like actually restoration of health, with hyperthyroidism, again, when you have those symptoms, elevated resting heart rate, losing a lot of weight, a lot of people have anxiety, insomnia, hair loss. I mean, again, we want to do things to, and also underlying things like affecting bone density. When you have like crazy high thyroid hormone levels, increases the turnover of the bone. So that over time could lead to osteopenia, osteoporosis. I mean, it takes time for that to happen.
Is it breaking down to get the calcium to use somewhere, or is it breaking down to get protein to make sugar? Like why is it breaking down bones?
I think as far as and again, there's not a lot in the literature, but again, I think it's just the accelerated metabolism in this case. Everything's like sped up. So you just have, really the osteoblast can't keep up with the demand. So it's pretty much just, again, the osteoclast breaking down the bone because of the increased metabolism. Again, that's another area where there's not a lot in the literature specifically as far as mechanisms, but either way, you lose, again, like bone loss is a concern. Yeah, like hypothyroidism, it seems like you're more a concern with the quality of bone when you have like low thyroid hormones for quite a long time, but you're actually losing bone density with hyperthyroidism with the research I've done. And then, I mean, we could go on, talk about this for a while too, like inflammation itself from the autoimmune process seems to also affect the bone density, but that is getting more into the autoimmune process. With the thyroid hormones, most people are given anti-thyroid medication that kind of like blocks the production of thyroid hormone. So that was an option when I dealt with hyperthyroidism, but I learned about an herbal approach. I don't know if you heard of the herb bugleweed.
At the Mindful Movement Podcast, we talk a lot about the small shifts that make a big difference. And lighting, it's one of the most overlooked pieces of your well-being. That's why we're excited to share Chromalux light bulbs from healthlighting.com. These aren't your average light bulbs. Chromalux lights are designed to support your natural rhythms, reducing unnatural light spectrums and supporting a more balanced environment that feels better for your eyes and your mind. The difference is not just seen, but felt. Whether you're curating your workspace, winding down in the evening, or just trying to make your home feel a little more peaceful, the right light matters. Sarah and I have been steadily making the switch throughout our home, and its impact really makes a difference. It's honestly kind of hard to explain, but the space has become noticeably more inviting. If you're ready to bring more intention into your environment, head to healthlighting.com and explore Chromalux bulbs. And as a part of our Mindful community, you can get a special discount. Just use code MINDFULMOVEMENT at checkout. Light your space, support your mind, and keep on moving. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space. No, I haven't.
Yeah. So
can you say that again? Is that with a B?
B, yeah. BugleWeed.
Okay. What is and, that? And that blocks the conversion?
Doesn't block the conversion. It seems like it affects the TSH stimulation of thyroid hormone. So it prevents that stimulation. And as a result, that's preventing or reducing the formation of thyroid hormone. So I learned about that during one of the seminars that I took for my CE credits. And so I took that to help lower the thyroid hormone levels. And again, not knowing if it would work because I never had anybody else who did that, but I took it. I followed their recommendations, their guidelines as far as like what to take. I took like a 1-to-2 extract ratio, and like there's different potencies of not just bugleweed but other herbs. So, you know, I took like a teaspoon twice a day of what they recommended, and you know, I noticed a difference symptom wise. Like I didn't do a blood test until a month later, but symptom wise, I noticed the heart rate decrease. You know, measuring the heart rate, so noticed the pulse rate decreasing, palpitations also were being helped, were reducing. And so, so it doesn't work for everyone for whatever reason. I mean, maybe it works like 70-75% of the time, which is still pretty good, but there are some people that take bugleweed and absolutely doesn't do anything. But with me, it did work and it helped me to prevent taking an antithyroid medication. And there are other agents too. Like I'm sure you're familiar with L-carnitine, and L-carnitine, given for other conditions, usually you don't hear about it for hyperthyroidism, because I mean there are people with hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, that take it for like fatty acid oxidation, for example. But in the literature,
that's what I know. Carnitine is an amino acid that helps shuttle fatty acid into the Krebs cycle, maybe, or is that?
Well, it's part of the Krebs cycle with the fatty acid. Yeah, again, I wish I remembered all the biochemistry associated with the Krebs cycle. But what I was going to say is in the literature, L-carnitine in higher doses, 2,000 to 4,000 milligrams per day, has been shown to block the entry of thyroid hormone into the cell. And I don't know why it's doing that. I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Isabella Wentz.
Yeah, I've heard. Yeah,
She's like the Hashimoto's expert. And she interviewed me for her podcast, and she was like talking about another mechanism, like what people with Hashimoto's do fine, even with higher amounts of that. So again, she was almost like suggested it was adaptogenic, you know, like some herbs are adaptogenic, right. Like L-carnitine wouldn't have a negative effect in those with hypothyroidism, which again, I can't say I've given high amounts to people with hypo Hashimoto's, but it sounds like she has some experience with that. But again, I have given some people, I didn't personally take L-carnitine at the time because I wasn't aware of it, but I'm bringing it up because it is another option that, and again, that's there are some studies, not a lot of studies, but there are a couple of studies. Actually, one I think shows, I don't know if you're familiar with thyroid storm, when everything gets when elevated levels get extremely high, and usually it's an emergency situation, but L-carnitine has been shown to help in cases of thyroid storm. Now, again, that wouldn't be my approach. If someone has a thyroid storm, I'd say go to the ER. If your levels are really high and you're having faintness, dizziness, those types of symptoms, I mean, that's something you want to probably use medicine to address. But point is, there's more than one study showing it can potentially be effective for hyperthyroidism. So there are some natural options to potentially avoid the antithyroid medication. But I will say I do have a lot of patients also take the antithyroid medication, and if they're taking it, they're tolerating it well. I'm fine with it. I mean, side effects are common with the antithyroid meds, but it's all about being safe while trying to restore one's health.
What kind of side effects do they get from those?
So with there's methimazole and what's called propylthiouracil or PTU, and so some of the side effects, putting stress on the liver, elevating the liver enzymes, lowering white blood cell count, are so those are like two of the more common ones. Again, not everybody, but those when endocrinologists recommend those medications, they'll typically recommend a CBC, they'll typically recommend a hepatic panel or a comprehensive metabolic panel that looks at the liver enzymes. So those are probably two of the more common signs on a blood test. But symptom-wise, I mean, of course, it can make someone hypo. That's one of the issues. A lot of endocrinologists will start someone on a really high dose of antithyroid medication, and the person might become super hypo and start experiencing hypothyroid symptoms, and then eventually need the dose reduced, and they could experience other symptoms like getting
Gotcha.
hair loss and all that. I mean, some people do get like GI issues, rashes. Again, there's a whole bunch of symptoms, and some of them are more common than others, but it's not uncommon for someone to be on the antithyroid meds and say, "Hey, I got a bunch of rashes, or I got some headaches, or I guess I just don't feel well being on antithyroid medication."
Okay. So, I mean, do you think what do you think are the more common, like, underlying root causes that make somebody hyperthyroid in the first place? Like, I know you mentioned that there, I think I was reading some of your stuff mentioning like a gut thyroid connection that has significance. I mean, do you think that a lot of the folks that have hyper, it's just stemming from dietary things jacking up the gut, or whether like lifestyle, I don't know, bad habits?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. Again, in my case, the stress, I definitely think that was a factor. And I mean, not all practitioners do adrenal testing, but when I dealt with Graves, I did an adrenal saliva test, and everything was in the tank. Cortisol was low, DHEA was low, secretory IgA was low. So I'm sure that was a factor. Was it the main factor? Was it a contributing factor? I'm not sure, but that definitely was a factor. But yeah, diet.
But wouldn't an overactive thyroid drive those up? Like, don't we use thyroid to convert like cholesterol to all those hormones? So
Yeah.
in theory, if there was a lot of thyroid, wouldn't we like be converting more or too much? Like, wouldn't they be high?
Sometimes we see that. It's funny you mentioned cholesterol, though, because, like again, you need cholesterol for those processes. And cholesterol, you probably know this from having a lot of hypothyroid experts on your show. Usually, with hypothyroidism, cholesterol is usually high. With hyperthyroidism, you don't have a lot of cholesterol. Like again, you usually see lower
Whoa.
cholesterol, so you don't have the same precursor to develop the. And I'm not saying that's the reason why everything is low, but it's not uncommon for me to see someone with hyperthyroidism whose total cholesterol is like 130, for example. So it's not like depleted and like 60 or 70, but still, it's you definitely have the
But
lower
you
cholesterol.
don't know which one comes first. Like, it could be the high metabolism that's driving that down, or it could be they're not getting enough dietary cholesterol, and there's not enough substrate to make that stuff
Yeah.
downstream.
I think, yeah, I mean, it's probably, I mean, in all likelihood, it's probably the metabolism. So I agree. It's, but I mean, you do see sometimes high I'm not saying everybody, it's depleted the cortisol levels. And again, we can make the argument that someone maybe who initially is diagnosed with hyperthyroidism, maybe we would see high cortisol initially, and then over time, you know, it takes time for
Deplete.
the, for, yeah, exactly, for those to get low. But I mean, as far as the gut, I do think the gut's important, not just for Graves, but for all autoimmune conditions. I mean, most of the immune system cells are in the gut. You've had others, I'm sure, talk about increased intestinal permeability, leaky gut, you know, potentially being a factor. And yeah, like dietary factors. Again, I'm sure you've had people talk about gluten and the effects on, the permeability of the gut, which is also again one of the part of that triad of autoimmunity.
Do you do any
And
testing for permeability? From what I understand, it's a little, I mean, I hear mixed feedback of whether that's useful, accurate, valuable.
I don't real so years ago, are you familiar with Cyrex Labs?
I've heard of them. Yeah, they do. Is that the place to test, like, what is it, zonulin or something? Or.
Well, they have, yeah, they do have an intestinal permeability test that looks at the antibodies associated with zonulin and other leaky gut markers like lipopolysaccharides. So it's not like a stool test will look at actually zonulin itself. It's looking at antibodies associated with zonulin and another one called occludin and lipo. So I used to do a lot of Cyrex Labs testing for leaky gut, and this was years ago, and most people would test positive. But I guess a few reasons I stopped. One, it's like, well, it's not telling. I mean, one is even those who are negative, I would question like, how accurate is this test? Is, you know, like, I mean, possibility of false positives, false negatives. More so, again, I question the false negatives. But then it's not telling us, even if these people have a leaky gut, what's causing a leaky gut.
Right.
So it's like I'd rather them spend a couple of $100 elsewhere, and, you know, so I don't really, even like if I do a stool test, which I don't do with everybody, but if I do like a GI map or GI, well, I don't know if GIFX offers zonulin, but GI map, zonulin's an add-on. I usually don't add it on. The patient might want to add it on. And I mean, if it's elevated, yeah, they probably have a leaky gut, but if it's depressed, or I'm not depressed, if it's normal, it probably doesn't rule out a leaky gut. So
It's not going to
yeah,
change your recommendations. So.
Pretty much, yeah. So I don't I just, yeah, I don't do any specific leaky gut testing these days, and I think a lot of practitioners also take that approach where they just assume that the gut is a factor.
You mentioned LPS. At the Mindful Movement podcast, we talk a lot about the small shifts that make a big difference. And lighting, it's one of the most overlooked pieces of your well-being. That's why we're excited to share Chromalux light bulbs from healthlighting.com. These aren't your average light bulbs. Chromalux lights are designed to support your natural rhythms, reducing unnatural light spectrums and supporting a more balanced environment that feels better for your eyes and your mind. The difference is not just seen, but felt. Whether you're curating your workspace, winding down in the evening, or just trying to make your home feel a little more peaceful, the right light matters. Sarah and I have been steadily making the switch throughout our home, and its impact really makes a difference. It's honestly kind of hard to explain, but the space has become noticeably more inviting. If you are ready to bring more intention into your environment, head to healthlighting.com and explore Chromalux bulbs. And as a part of our mindful community, you can get a special discount. Just use code MINDFULMOVEMENT at checkout. Light your space, support your mind, and keep on moving. If you've been listening to this podcast for a while, you've probably heard me talk about how important it is to regulate your nervous system. This goes for healing, for focus, for just overall emotional well-being. But the reality is that even if we know the tools to help do this, whether it's breathing or meditation or just slowing down, it can still be really hard to stay regulated throughout a busy day. That's one reason I've really been interested in the Apollo wearable by Apollo Neuro. Sarah and I both use this device regularly and have found it very beneficial. It's a small wearable device that uses gentle vibrations, and they're designed to signal safety to your nervous system. What's fascinating is that those signals can help your body shift out of a stress state and into a calmer, more regulated state. What I like about it, most of all, is that even though it can work great alongside practices like meditation or breath work, the real value is that you can wear it throughout your day, even while you're at work, and just let it work its magic on your nervous system. The other standout use that I rely on is wearing it to bed. Not only does it help me fall asleep fast, but I often wake up around 3 a.m. and I can just tap the button on it and it will help lull me back to sleep quickly. If you want to learn more, check out the podcast episode with the founder, David Rabin, and you could explore more about the technology itself. But if you're someone that struggles with anxiety or feeling wired or overwhelmed, or you're simply looking for more nervous system support in daily life, it might be something worth exploring. You can learn more about the Apollo wearable and how it works and save $99 on a new device at apolloneuro.com/mindful or click the link in the show notes. I promise you won't regret this investment. I truly believe it's the best bang for the buck in the wellness tech space. Yes. So do you, I guess in the context of that test, do you feel like that plays a big role in this? Like if you, whether you have leaky gut or you just have too much LPS or endotoxin that is being, I guess, released from whatever's in someone's microbiome, could that be, do you feel like that plays a role, a significant role in like whatever immunological, like stimulating insult?
I think it could. Now, is it in everybody? Again, I'm not sure. Going back to the Cyrex Labs test, not everybody with autoimmunity had positive antibodies to lipopolysaccharides. Is that because it's not a factor in everybody? Is it because it's not accurate enough to detect it in everybody?
But what's the relevance of having an antibody? Like, why do you need an antibody to show up for the actual toxin that's being secreted to be like triggering the immune system? Do you need an antibody to be in that process for that process to have an immunological response?
No, you probably don't need the antibody. I mean, that's the basis behind a Cyrex Labs testing, like all, or I don't know all, but a lot of their tests, like for example, if, I don't know if you're familiar with their chemical sensitivity test. Like most practitioners who do testing for toxins will look at levels in the urine, in the hair, things like that, in the blood. They look at the immune system response because it's a little bit different than what you're asking. But for example, their argument is, well, just because someone has low levels of mercury doesn't mean that they can't have an immune response to mercury. So they like it's their array number 11 that looks at this. So if you do their test for mercury and it's elevated, then again, it doesn't matter if it's lower on a, according to them, it doesn't matter if it's lower on another like test that's just measuring levels, it's immune response. So with their leaky gut test, it's also looking at the immune response. Now, do you need the immune response? Same thing. Isn't it just okay enough just to look at zonulin rather than like the immune system response to zonulin and occludin? So I'm not sure. That's a good question for Cyrex Labs.
Because I think a lot of people have that. Like, I think a lot of people have too much bacteria or fungal stuff, or like just too much stuff in the gut. And you see it in like bloating or and you see it manifest in a lot of different ways. And a lot of people do well when that amount is reduced. And you see, like, you see this with these diets now where there's a dramatic reduction in fiber. There's a dramatic reduction in like the substrate that the things in the gut, which are supposed to be things we need, but in some type of balance are feeding on. And when they take it out, good things happen to them, at least for some period of time. Though, even if it's not like a good long-term diet for them, or it'll come at a different price if they do it long-term, they get this like symptom relief. And I wonder how much of that is just all this LPS and endotoxin being released that because they have too much bacteria, too much whatever microbiome they have, and they're benefiting from just reducing that. And that's why I wonder, like, if, like, why would you need an antibody marker to know, like, you if you reduce fiber or reduce FODMAPs and you get better, then those LPS were probably bothering you, and there probably wouldn't have been an antibody. So, or there might have been, but it would have been like, who cares if there's an antibody showing up on a lab? What matters is, like, the bacteria, the toxin itself is triggering, a toll receptor or some kind of something that's triggering the system.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. So if like someone has SIBO, small intestinal bacteria overgrowth, like what's the relevance of testing the antibodies? Just maybe it's just a consequence of having that overgrowth that you have in those
Right.
lipopolysaccharides. And yeah, I agree. Like I said, it's been a long time since I've done the testing routinely, and even now it's been I don't know how many years since I've done it at all. Usually, if I test for it, it's because the patient is like insisting on doing a leaky gut test. Whereas you're right, with SIBO, again, I've done SIBO breath test, and yeah, I do agree to as far as what you're saying. I'm not sure if that is the case because again, we don't know for sure. Like if someone has small intestinal bacteria overgrowth, so that excess of bacteria, is the lipopolysaccharides associated with that because they have that excess of bacteria, or same thing, you do a GI map and you see a lot of opportunistic bacteria. You could assume that, the lipopolysaccharides are a factor because you have a lot of those opportunistic bacteria. I mean, again, it is a good theory.
So what is your go-to? Like, let's say somebody comes in, they don't feel well. Maybe they have some of the symptoms that you discussed you had, maybe the rapid weight loss, which a lot of people would probably welcome and pat themselves on the back and for a while before they see it as a problem. And then maybe their heart rate's funky, or they get the anxiety or palpitations. They come in, you do blood work, and you get these blood markers that corroborate the symptoms a little bit in the story, and says, looks like there's some hyper. Where do you typically begin as far as other than maybe the herb you mentioned? Like, what are the strategies, the low hanging fruit that move the needle for, like, most people most of the time?
I mean, it's always going to start with diet and lifestyle, just again, eating whole healthy foods, anti-inflammatory diet. I like a paleo type diet, autoimmune paleo type diet in some cases. You were kind of referring to, well, you mentioned low FODMAP, but also there's the carnivore diet, which again, I usually don't recommend a carnivore diet, but when you said like some people do well with out the fiber with the or low fiber, there are some there is some evidence of not necessarily in the literature, but a lot of people out there who have done well from an autoimmune standpoint on carnivore. But again, I can't say I take that approach. It's more of a paleo, autoimmune, paleo, AIP approach. So it's not like they're not eating.
Could you review what those are? I remember, it's been a while since I've been thinking about paleo, even though I probably went early in my, like, health journey, that was the diet du jour, for sure, paleo, and then the autoimmune paleo came out. So paleo is basically like whole foods, like not taking, you're just essentially taking out processed foods for the most part. And then the autoimmune paleo, like, subcategory is taking out further what, common allergens, or is it taking out grains? What is it taking out?
Yeah, well, actually, paleo, you're not eating grains with paleo too. So
Okay.
the main difference between autoimmune paleo and paleo is that autoimmune paleo, you're avoiding eggs, nuts, and seeds, and you're also avoiding nightshades, so like tomatoes, eggplant, peppers, white potatoes, and with nightshades, potential. And again, as far as like the reasons, because that's probably the next question, like why are we avoiding, these foods? These are, I mean, eggs are whole healthy foods. I mean, I eat eggs on a regular basis and good source of protein, good source of nutrients. Again, I also like my nuts and seeds as well. So, but and same thing, nightshades too. So it's part of an elimination diet. Even like with paleo diet, you're avoiding like grains, for example. It doesn't mean everybody's going to do bad on grains. It also you're avoiding legumes. Doesn't mean everybody's going to do bad on eating legumes. But you're and same thing with dairy. There are some people that do great with raw dairy or dairy from a goat or I mean, even some people with cow's milk, again, the raw dairy from a cow. But point is, with like nightshades and a lot and some people they have alkaloids, glycoalkaloids that could affect the gut, potentially prevent healing of the gut, can potentially be inflammatory.
Wait, what did you
And
say? Peeling of the gut?
no, healing,
Oh,
healing.
healing. Okay. So they're basically just taking out more things that are just common gut irritants of some sort.
Pretty much. I mean, eggs are also, again, a lot of people tolerate eggs, but they're a common allergen too. So
Allergen.
even like even other elimination diets, a lot of them will avoid
So
eggs.
the idea is really to just get nutrition, but let the immune response like settle.
Pretty much, just try to get, I mean, you could eat, a lot of people do eat a lot of meat, poultry, beef, fish. Again, they're usually eating plant-based foods, but that's where if someone can't tolerate plant-based foods like vegetables, that maybe they will follow more of like a carnivore type diet and like avoid like the vegetables. But if they can't, like when I was dealing with Graves, I was able to tolerate fruits and vegetables. And I mean, it's definitely restrictive, and it's not a long term. I mean, there's no, I think we both agree, there's no diet that fits everyone perfectly, and not every practitioner will obviously recommend AIP to everyone. And it depends. Like if someone's really stressed out with autoimmune protocol, let's just follow paleo diet. It's not like it's impossible to heal. I mean, paleo diet's still pretty healthy. It's just that if someone is following paleo and 3 months go by and they're not getting results, we don't know if it's due to the eggs or the
Right.
nightshades, you know, but if they're following AIP and they're not healing, we can't look back and we can't say, okay, like we know it's not the nightshades because you've been avoiding the
Right.
nightshades. Maybe it is something else, like something going on in the gut or a toxic mold issue or something like that.
And then what else? So let's say somebody's in that beginning process and they're trying one of these dietary interventions, and maybe it's either not moving the needle or moving the needle to some degree, but they don't feel like they're, 100%. What is the next like intervention that you look at?
I mean, some of that will depend on the health history, and the health history might, even if they're like, if getting back to like the SIBO example, if I'm working with someone and they're having a lot of gas and bloating like from day one, now A, that might change my recommendations. It might not be AIP because again, like they maybe it would be low FODMAP, for example. But also in that case, I might recommend let's do a SIBO breath test. I mean, we could also assume sometimes based on the symptoms, but you know, I'm more conservative with the testing, but I do like to do some testing if it's justified, especially with the health history. So like in that case, maybe we do the SIBO test. But so it really depends. Some of it might depend on the health history. There's a time and place for comprehensive stool panels, even though they're not perfect too. But if someone's having heartburn, reflux, maybe we look at H. pylori just individually or part of a stool test. And interestingly, I don't know if anybody else has mentioned this. Now, I know correlation doesn't always mean causation, but there are some journal articles that show relationship between H. pylori and Graves as well as Hashimoto's. And again, there's different perspectives on H. pylori. Some people say just live in harmony. You know, if you're not experiencing symptoms, don't do anything. But again, if I work with someone and if they, let's say again, they have Graves' disease and they do test positive for H. pylori, even in the absence of symptoms, I'm not going to recommend to take two antibiotics and a PPI, which is a conventional treatment, but I will recommend to take an herbal, to take a natural approach, like a natural antimicrobial approach. And I've had some people get into remission that way. Now, that's not usually the only thing we're doing. So was it the H. pylori protocol by itself? Was it the dietary intervention, the stress management? Because that's a big factor too, not just what they eat, but blocking out time for stress management, which of course you and Sarah experts in with your show. But I mean,
You know,
so
that's a good point though. Like, I one thing that And thank you. I know you're welcoming Sarah onto your show soon, so
Yeah.
that's exciting. I think it's a good fit there and a different angle for your listeners probably to hear about. But I know with I've been trying to navigate gut stuff that is really has like an ebb and flow, and a lot of it started around a time where there was like massive emotional stress. And I got Lyme disease, and then I had the antibiotics from the Lyme, and it's just never been like, oh, I've got a couple periods where I'm like 95% better, I feel like, but never like 100. So I keep like staying curious and tinkering. But one thing that does stand out is when I have stress arise around like family relationship stress, stuff that dates back to like childhood, like that even though I've done, you know, so much like work on through different modalities, there's no question that my gut stuff and then the things that seem to react in relationship to that, whether it's like my skin or my sleep, they get worse with the with like the emotional or mental stress. And it's, you know, that stuff just doesn't just go away. You know, like and I don't know, and probably out of all the ways to process the emotions and stresses that we encounter, like there's different ones that are going to work better for different people, but it definitely seems like it has to always remain on the list of boxes you're checking when you're trying to heal from something, even if it might seem totally unrelated because you're dealing with like heart palpitations or skin reactions or things that, you know, from the outside might seem like, well, how could that have anything to do with, I don't know, feelings of abandonment from childhood or like whatever, you know, your version of that is of like shit that you're just dealing with. That's still like being stored in your body, in your tissue somewhere. There's like a memory that's just still there, like gripping to try to help you some way, but it has, by now that you're an adult, that help has backfired.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, and I think most practitioners would, at least natural practitioners, functional medicine practitioners would say that there's a relationship between stress and most chronic health conditions. If you do a search, like a PubMed search of Graves and stress, you'll actually see some journal articles related to that too. So it does seem to, and I mean, you probably, other practitioners who focus on other conditions probably see this in their health history. But again, when I have someone fill out a health history, almost everybody is rating stress as high, stress handling as low. Gotcha. Again, not everybody across the board, but I know I was in denial when I dealt with Graves. not that stress wasn't a factor, but I thought, oh, I was good at handling stress. Like stress didn't bother me, and realized then, and started to realize then and over the years that it was a big factor, and everybody should block out time on a regular basis. And I'm not saying that just because of you being here. Again, I talk about that a lot, just like it, not just the diet, but the stress management perspective, obviously sleep also important, but really getting to the foundations, you know, if you don't incorporate the foundations, eating healthy, stress management, proper sleep, it really is going to be difficult to heal.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I've worked in a gym environment for a while, and, you know, in the initial sessions where you're one-on-one with someone and you're diving in and getting like a glimpse into their state of stress and what drives it and what they do for it. Like, and I live in an area where it's like high productivity, you know, it's a go, 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 you know, people, there's a lot of doing and not a lot of being. And when you're going over these things, like the way people blow off when you mention stress or like, what do you do for stress management? It's like this assumption they may, or like, it's like they concede to like, life is stressful. There's nothing you can do about it. Like, or it's like, yeah, yeah, I get it. I got to work on my stress. Yeah, 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 yeah. What's the next thing? Like they're in the gym to try to solve some kind of physical health issue they want to improve on. And me trying to convey the importance of, if you don't get these other things lined up in the same direction of why you contacted me here in the gym, this experience isn't going to go as you think. Like, you can't out exercise all these other issues in your life. Like, if you're, it's really just going to be an additional new stress that you're layering on top of all these other stressors. And it's very tough to convey to an adult with like a 50-hour week job and a couple kids are running around and they still want to make time to get to the gym that, no, you actually have to prioritize like that. That part of the equation is not going away. And it might, that hill might just continue to climb for the rest of your life as long as you put it off and be harder and harder to work on. What are your go-to things when you do are discussing the stress management with your clients? Like, what are the strategies that you feel like are accessible where people do show a willingness to partake in and they get like some effective outcome from?
I mean, I usually try to keep it simple. I mean, first of all, I tell them do what you're willing to do. I mean, so like deep breathing, meditation, I think is great if they're willing to do that. Some people, they like to do yoga. But I also, I do recommend doing things every day. Like, it doesn't mean they have to do yoga every day, but the problem with yoga I see is that some people will, like, they might go to a yoga studio like 2 or 3 times a week and that's their stress management. But I would say, how about the other 3 or 4 days during the week? And so, I mean, a lot of people, the deep breathing, there's a lot of apps, as you know, now, like Headspace and the Calm app. And some people prefer using apps for stress management. So it really varies. I can't say there's a go-to because I leave it up to the person. I think a lot of things could be effective. And again, I'm really fascinated about and excited about talking with Sarah about hypnotherapy. And again, there's so many different types of mind-body medicines out there that I think it's what the person's willing to do right. on a regular basis. And
do you get good like compliance from your patients? Or do you get like excuses or fighting when it comes to the, like, I find people are just more, even though it could be really hard to change a dietary thing, I find that people are more willing to change a dietary thing than to like cut out 20 minutes for a leisurely walk in nature.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, yeah, there definitely are people that are compliant, but compared to the diet, and obviously there are people that fight the diet too and aren't compliant with that. But I would say, yeah, a lot of people, they focus on the diet and really don't do enough from a stress management perspective. So again, there's definitely exceptions to that. But yeah, I would say I would agree with you. More comply with the diet than with blocking out time on a regular basis for stress management.
As a chiropractor, is there, like, I guess there's a lot of things that could be insulting the nervous system, which really is governing so much, whether it's really like the whole migratory motor complex, like digestion as a whole and the flow of things, if you will. And, you know, that's sending signals up, disturbing that, you know, as if it's stressed or insulted, disturbing the pituitary, wreaking havoc on the signaling that's going to give, and then showing up in the thyroid or metabolism as a whole. Like, do you ever find where your chiropractic care is able to make a difference with like thyroid related things where it's like settling down the northbound insults that the body is interpreting from like things being out of positions or nerves being aggravated due to like structural whatever?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, chiropractic relates more to the nervous system. You know, a lot of people just associate with neck and back pain, which it can help with those. But yeah, like it is, again, I can't say I require all my patients to see a chiropractor, but being a chiropractor, I have seen where chiropractic can help like people with thyroid conditions, but also other conditions you would not normally associate with chiropractic.
Is there any link to like location? Like if the thyroid is up in the neck, like is it, they might be jacked up around there. Like their lower cervical spine, they'll have things that need to work on. And then it like makes, like, is it local like that where they could have dysfunction in the structure that's just as the crow flies, like right there, like nearby. And then when that area in general gets less inflamed because maybe a nerve's not being jabbed by a facet joint or something, and it gets cleared, that like the whole area kind of settles down and the thyroid could be happier.
It could be, and definitely, yeah. I mean, that's the first place I would look, is like lower cervical is up at thoracics. But then also we got to remember the communication, like that it's not just thyroid, but it's the hypothalamus and pituitary. Right. So like upper cervicals also could play a role. And I'm sure that's, again, the upper cervical specialist, which I'm not just focusing on upper cervicals, but I'm sure they also have a lot of success even without touching, you know, the lower cervicals, the upper thoracics, just because of that communication process.
Gotcha.
Of the hypothalamus and pituitary gland.
Because I remember, like, I know that I used to have back pain that I eventually drawed a connection to, like, intestinal inflammation. And eventually I realized, like, oh, these are, like, not even an inch apart. So, and I thought, like, well, if you cut yourself on your arm, the cut itself might be, you know, a fraction of a millimeter thick. But you get this, like, big inch and a half wide, inflamed, puffy area during the healing process, like, you know, it affects a much greater area than like the width of the knife that you got cut by. And I'm thinking, well, if my guts are inflamed because my diet's jacked, I'm stressed or whatever, well, the pain I'm feeling in my back, you know, it's only an inch or two away. Like, it's not crazy to think that if my intestines are inflamed and aggravated, that something nearby that is like in physical contact with might be affected by it.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, yeah, you're right about the proximity. So that's a possibility. And I mean, just in general, also, just as you know, gut health affects so many different things, you know, even like the gut brain connection and brain fog. And, you know, that years ago, we didn't really would associate gut health with effect. So right. Yeah, I would agree with that too.
Yeah, now I think that's finally being accepted, that like mental health and like the mental state in general is deeply connected to what's in the gut, which is great.
Agreed.
You know, progress, because that probably, you know, wasn't that long ago that stuff was like laughed at, or patients were laughed at or being told, you know, it's all in your head or whatever.
Yeah, agreed.
What else you want to share, Eric?
Well, I mean, we spoke about, I mean, I guess another thing worth mentioning too, even though, and again, I don't know if you want to go here because other guests might have spoken about that, but the endocrine disrupting chemicals that affect thyroid too, and it's not just the impact on thyroid, you know, things like plastics, microplastics included, and but also, you know, I've been doing research on that lately, and they also not only affect the thyroid directly, but can affect the gut, again, be a factor with permeability of the gut, which again is tied into these autoimmune conditions like Graves and Hashimoto's.
That feels like an overwhelming thing to try to deal with. Like, I know some people feel this when they discuss like EMF stuff. It's like, well, how do you live in this world and like dodge plastic? You know, it's like,
yeah.
You know, even if you try to eat something healthy and you go get, you know, maybe a high quality yogurt and it's in a plastic container, even if like you're OK, I've eliminated the plastic water bottles, I've eliminated it in all these places, like you're still getting it. You can't. It's like you can't hide from it. What do we do? Do we get better at detoxifying it, or do we, like, what is the strategy?
No, I think both. I mean, so just like for someone who's just drinking out of plastic water bottles on a daily basis, even just making that one change is big. Now, yeah, obviously there are all these other sources we're exposed to, but it's about trying to reduce one's toxic burden, not completely eliminating the toxic burden, because that's not going to happen. And you're right, we get plastic from so many other sources. So just trying to do the best that we can. And then, yeah, you're right about trying to reduce, like, as far as eliminating toxins and trying to do that as much as we can through diet and staying well hydrated. I do sauna like a few times a week. I did infrared sauna this morning to try to sweat out the toxins as much as
do you
much
know
as I
if
can.
Microplastics are pushed out through the sweat and sauna? Has that been tested? Do you know?
I don't know about, well, plastics, I'm pretty sure, xenoestrogens. And so that's, but I don't know specifically like the micro, I mean, you would think so, since they're so small, the microplastics and nanoplastics that they
I would
would be
think that,
excreted.
like, I'm a big believer in, like, trusting the inner wisdom. And even though, like, the structures, I think form is derived, emerges out of function. So even though our structures emerged with, over a long period of time where there wasn't any plastic and it didn't need to build a structure for that function, I think it's probably really resourceful. And I feel like the skin would be this big exit route for the inner wisdom to be looking at. And the things that if I don't have a liver pathway for this, I can't conjugate this, I don't understand it yet because it's only been here for a few decades or whatever. I would think that the skin would be like the, and the colon probably is like these avenues of like just blunt object tools, like push, and a lot of stuff can probably go out. But I don't know if anybody's like looked at that and how you would, I mean, I would think that it wouldn't be a hard study to put together. I don't think,
Yeah.
it would be real complicated, and you probably wouldn't have a problem with an IRB approving it. It probably is something that they could check out, and it would probably be really useful. I mean, sauna is fantastic and accessible for a lot of people. But the other question would be like, if it's not, can you still push those out by sweating in a more sympathetic way? Like, if you go for a jog on a hot day, are you still pushing those out? Or does that state of the nervous system matter? Where, like, do you have to have that like relaxed healing signal, like time for that parasympathetic response to the brain to say, okay, this is a good time to get this plastic shit out of here? Who
Yeah,
knows?
good question. Good question. Yeah, again, hopefully they will do some research, at least, at the very least, with the sauna. Like you said, that wouldn't be too difficult to do, and it wouldn't be surprising if they did that. I mean, there's a lot of studies now on microplastics, but I guess it just takes someone to go ahead and put together that study.
And what's the general, like, do you feel the real problem with those are the endocrine disruption where it's basically, is it like mimicking estrogen and or like it looks similar and it binds to an actual receptor where estrogens normally binds? Like, what do you know, like, how does it actually have its negative impact?
I mean, because again, it's so I think from what I've read, it does seem to mimic estrogen and bind to the estrogen receptors. But then it also, I've read where it binds to the thyroid receptors. So it's not mimic, I haven't seen where it like mimics thyroid hormone. But again, it's a xenoestrogen. So I guess it would make sense that it mimics like your body's natural estrogens. But somehow it also blocks and binds to the thyroid hormones, which is another way that it's, I guess you could say, an endocrine disruptor, or really the main way from a thyroid disruptor. But yeah, so those are the two ways that I know of. Again, mimicking estrogen, blocking the thyroid hormone receptors.
Have you gotten a signal from like any patient that once they took, let's say, plastic mitigation like seriously, that they moved a needle where like that has been isolated to be like a turning point of their healing journey?
I mean, it's hard to say because again, I do so many things other, like again, just like
Right.
any other functional medicine practitioner, that's going to be one thing that we recommend to like cut out the plastic water bottles, for example. And if someone sees significant results, that they're also usually making dietary changes, hopefully blocking out time for stress management, improving other areas of the body. So yeah, it's one other thing also I do want to bring up that I think you find interesting. Have you heard of others in the thyroid world talk about cruciferous vegetables and goitrogens?
Briefly, yeah, mostly in the context of like the carnivore people that are pretty anti-cruciferous vegetables.
Yeah. So the, the concern is that cruciferous vegetables can inhibit thyroid hormone production. And so like if someone has Hashimoto's, they shouldn't eat cruciferous vegetables. So I'm bringing it up because I intentionally, like years ago, I had Especially like pregnant women, a lot of pregnant women don't want to take medication. So again, I can't tell them not to take medication, but if they didn't, I was just trying to think what they could take because bugleweed isn't an option when pregnant. We don't know really anything about it. So I'm like, well, why don't we test the goitrogenic theory and have these women eat large amounts, like a few cups of raw broccoli per day, whatever they were willing to eat to see if it will slow down the thyroid and inhibit it. And I honestly didn't see that. So that's another reason why, like, when someone asked me about goitrogens, should I worry about goit?
So
And
wait,
usually.
they were hyper and you were trying to slow down their thyroid by giving them broccoli.
Exactly. Yeah. I was trying to naturally lower it by eating, giving them large amounts. Because we get a lot of people with Hashimoto's, for example, saying, should I avoid the goitrogenic vegetables? I mean, should I avoid cruciferous vegetables? And I always go back to that. Well, I intentionally try to lower thyroid hormones by giving large amounts of those cruciferous vegetables. And I don't remember one person like where it's actually helped them feel better, let alone showed a big difference on a blood test. So.
That's interesting. The thing is like that's a variable that might interact with other things given sloppy data too. Like I think broccoli has compounds in it that affect detoxification. And so like who there's so many moving parts. You know, we're such a dynamic system, you know. It's complex. It's like
That is true.
interesting. Well, hey man, I really enjoyed this. Eric, like I said, I have This is the first conversation I think in my life with anybody really about hyperthyroid, where I get to talk about that and learn something. So I appreciate you sharing your wisdom. And it sounds like it's a pretty cool story. Like we've heard a lot from really functional medicine docs where they either got like failed by the Western system and switched sides, or they had to heal themselves somehow and learned a lot on the way, and then feel passionate about sharing that info. So it's great to hear another scenario like that. If people want to learn more about your stuff, you host a podcast, Save My Thyroid Podcast. Is that the name of it, right? Save My
Yep,
Thyroid.
same at the hour, yep.
Is that mostly interviews or is it
It's
solos?
a combination. It's a combination. On Tuesdays, I release an episode on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So Thursday is usually just a solo episode, usually a shorter episode. Whereas Tuesday, that's when I'll do interviews. Sometimes I'll do a longer solo episode on Tuesday. But yeah, I usually do like one or two interviews per month, and then the rest are like solo episodes. Or I also do audits with not patients but non-patients, like someone who just has, let's say, hyperthyroidism, and they just want to hop on and have me go over like one of their health challenges for like 20 minutes, 25
And
minutes,
you do that on the
and
podcast? Or you're saying you do, or you're saying you just do that, like you provide that service one on one?
No, on the
Oh,
podcast,
that's cool. That's
on the
great.
podcast, like usually like once, sometimes twice a month, I'll have what's called a Save My Thyroid Health Audit on the
Oh,
podcast.
that's
So,
nice. What a great idea. I'm sure people can get a lot of benefit out of that. And then do you still see patients, taking new patients like one on one, or
I do.
is
Yeah.
that virtually, or does it have do they have to be in your area?
Pretty much these days it is remote. It is through telemedicine.
And if people want to find out more about that, where should they go?
They could, I mean, they work with Dr. Eric if they want to learn more about working with me. Again, they could go to savemythyroid.com, check out the podcast. Or again, there's also a link to work with Dr. Eric. But if they want to find out more about me, definitely listen more to the podcast or check out one of my books.
Okay, great. And we'll link to those in the show notes. Eric, I appreciate you taking time. And for the listeners out there, grateful for your listening. I hope you got some value out of the conversation today. And if you feel like you want some help and you're struggling with something and you think Dr. Eric would be someone that's the right fit, then reach out to him. And I wish you all the luck. Thanks, everybody. Have a great day.
Thanks, Les.